From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's antiquated road funding formula dating back to 1951.
And it hasn't been updated in decades. I looked, and the last time there really was any serious modification to the formula was back in the early 80s.
The Michigan woman who's fighting for the thousands of kids who are lost in foster care.
Could you imagine if 88 parents dropped their kids off at public school and then 88 kids every week weren't there when you went back to pick them up at the end of the school day? Like, people would be marching in the streets about this.
How it all began for the founder of Bell's Brewery.
Jimmy Carter legalized home brewing in 1980. I moved into a house with some other guys, all like beer, and went out and bought a kit and started brewing in my basement.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today we introduce you to a Michigan woman fighting for the thousands of kids who are lost in foster care.
There are numerous cases where a kid has disappeared and a foster family has continued cashing checks and nobody even knows that the child is gone or missing.
A conversation with Traverse City-based author and advocate Shenandoah Sheffalo, who herself entered the foster care system at the age of 13. But first,
am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
This week, Governor Snyder is expected to sign a bill sending an extra $175 million in one-time funds to our state and local roads. That money supplements $2.3 billion in ongoing funds this year. Kirk Steidel, director of the Michigan Department of Transportation, joins us again to answer another question about Michigan's roads right here on Stateside. We know that even with the supplemental budget, there still isn't enough to fix all the roads in Michigan, and that leads to today's Am I Curious question.
My name is Julie Chewy, and I'm from Westland, Michigan. How does the state choose which projects are priority? Why do lower-income areas seem to receive less quality and quantity of funds than the higher-income areas?
Kirk?
So there's a lot to that question. First of all, let's split it out with the funding distribution. So there's a formula within state law that determines how the money gets distributed to all of those 600 agencies across the state. You put the money in the top and you turn the crank and out it comes. That's really based on population, miles of roads. There's an additional factor for winter for certain areas, particularly like the UP, they get lots and lots of snow. So that formula helps kick it out to all of those different agencies. Now, when you get within an agency, you know, why you decide to spend money on this street versus the other street or this highway versus that one, it really is from an engineering perspective. It's an asset management approach where we look at this entire network of roads and you're looking to say, how do I hold these together? So think of it this way. We've all seen the picture of the guy at the circus that's spinning the plates. He's got a long stick and there's a plate on top and they're all spinning, right? So some of them he gives a really good turn and they sit and spin for a long time. Others he just gives a quick turn just to keep them going. That's kind of the same thing that happens with roads. Some, you know, when it's about ready to fall off, he's got to give it a really big spin to get it to stay up there and, you know, keep going for a long time. Others, you're just doing a repair work that's going to last 5 to 10 years.
Okay. That point that the listener made about lower income areas versus higher income areas, how do you address that question?
So, you know, a road is a road is a road, but the formula sends money. It doesn't know which areas are more affluent than another. It just knows there's this many miles of road in a certain area, there's this type of population, this amount of population, and that's what ultimately produces the revenue that comes up. The miles are the big thing.
That was Kirk Steidel, director of the Michigan Department of Transportation. Now, my next guest believes the road funding formula Director Steidel was referencing is outdated and it does not address the way we use our roads. Craig Thiel of the Citizens Research Council is here to make a case for a better way of dividing up highway funding. Now, safe to say, Craig, we can all agree on the fact our roads are plagued with potholes and they're a symptom of their poor overall condition. Is this latest road funding package enough to get a good start on fixing them?
Well, to your point, Cindy, no question the roads are in need of investment. This is a problem that we've been dealing with for decades, and funding is definitely needed. The question becomes, how do we allocate that funding to get the biggest bang for the buck? And unfortunately, our current formula for doing so doesn't guarantee the taxpayers, the citizens of Michigan, that we will get the biggest bang for the buck because of an outdated method for sending those dollars both to the state transportation department, but then to the local road agencies who are filling potholes, reconstructing roads, and maintaining the infrastructure for us.
And how old is this highway revenue sharing formula that we use?
Well, it's called Public Act 51 of 1951. So we're looking at over a half a century of formula funding method. And it hasn't been updated in decades. I looked, and the last time there really was any serious modification to the formula was back in the early 80s.
So using this antiquated formula, how is that money then divvied up among the state and the counties and the cities? Because it's clear you feel that this approach is failing us.
Right. So there's a allocation among levels of government first, and this is Public Act 51 has percentages. And so roughly 39% goes to the state transportation department, and then another 39% goes to the county road commissions, and then the remaining 22% goes to cities and villages who maintain roads. So those percentages are fixed in the statute, regardless of the condition of the roads across all of Michigan. It's that set 39-39-22. Then once the dollars hit those road agencies, then they're allocated within those local communities based on a whole series of formulas, many of which don't make any sense in today's kind of infrastructure picture, if you will. They're kind of proxy measures of how we allocate among the individual county road commissions as well as the cities and villages.
So the upshot is the roads most in need of repair aren't necessarily getting the money they need.
That's right. So we use metrics that are supposed to equally distribute the funding, and there's really no measure of use, like how much each mile of highway is used in an individual community, or the actual need of the community when we distribute those dollars. We use proxy measures, things like population and the number of miles, but the actual number of miles traveled on those roads or some method of determining, you know, the degree of deterioration isn't used in distributing the revenue to the local communities.
So what do you think would be a better way to do this?
A better method would be use, and that would be vehicle miles traveled, actually calculating and distributing the funds based on how many cars travel over each mile of highway rather than using just the mile of highway that's in existence. So that would be a use factor. A need factor would be, you know, actually assessing the condition of each road and then distributing resources to individual counties, individual cities and villages based on the condition of those roads. I'm sure there's a need across the state for additional funding, but the highest need areas are not getting the bulk of the money in this formula.
So, Craig, using this idea of for more efficiently allocating state highway funds, how might that make a difference on the ground?
Well, I think what would happen is we would see those roads that have the greatest use and those that are in the highest need of the resources would get a larger share of the proportion, a larger share of the funding from this $175 million. As it's going to go out, every road agency in the state is going to get about 8% increase in road funding, but we know that each jurisdiction has a different level of need. The state system might have a higher need than the local system, but the way Public Act 51 works, it's basically sprinkling the infield with a little bit of funding for everybody.
What are the politics that has us still using Public Act 51 from 1951, using this formula that goes back to the middle of the last century? Well, how did this come to be?
Right. So the politics are pretty straightforward. It's an issue that, you know, raising the gas tax or transportation taxes are always a challenge and they're always a touchy subject. But when the politicians, you know, decide to do it, then they shift their attention to, you know, how the funding is going to get distributed. And that's when the cities and the counties all kind of perk their ears up and decide, well, you know, we want our share of the pot. And Public Act 51 was agreed to decades ago. And no one really wants to disrupt the apple cart in this one, because if you start changing the formula, you're going to have winners and losers. And clearly the communities that are losing are going to be the ones who kind of voices are heard the loudest.
Anyone who wants to share thoughts and ideas about Michigan's roads and infrastructure, this is your chance. Tomorrow, Tuesday, March 20th, 8 to 9:30 in the morning at the Michigan Chamber of Commerce offices in Lansing, there's a leaders issue forum. And you've got three big decision makers being there talking roads and taking questions. Who have you got lined up?
Yeah, so we have Representative Tristan Cole representing the the House's perspective on this issue. We have Senator Tom Casperson from the UP, who's the head of the Transportation Committee in the Senate. He's going to be there. And then we have Director of Transportation Kirk Steidel, all offering their perspective on infrastructure generally, but with a focus, because of the current condition of our road system, talking about road infrastructure in the state.
And anyone welcome to attend and bring questions?
It's open to the public. We do have limited seating, so get registered as soon as possible.
And you can do that by going to crcmich.org. Craig Thiel, Citizens Research Council, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Just a reminder, this is our last full day of winter. Spring steps into our lives at 12:15 Tuesday afternoon. However, don't let the beautiful weather we enjoyed yesterday lull you into thinking winter is out of here. We are in for a blast of Canadian Arctic air to blow in here, bringing us colder than average temperatures and the chance of a lovely mix of rain and snow possible for Saturday. Forecasters also say they're watching three storm systems that have drawn a bead on the Great Lakes region for the next week or two. So the upshot is we're probably not quite done with snow yet, nor is it time to put the winter coat in the back of the closet. But at least after 12:15 tomorrow, we can tell ourselves it is spring. Coming up, Kalamazoo brewer Larry Bell on three decades of Michigan's beer scene.
I got a check for my birthday for $200. And that's what I started the company with. I wrote to the federal government, said, what do I have to do to get a license? Because I got to make this legal.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is so much renovation and new development happening in Detroit. But how many of the people designing those spaces are people who will use them? And that question drives Tiffany Brown, a co-founder of the Urban Arts Collective. She is an architectural designer who won a 2017 Knight Arts Challenge grant with her idea for bringing more women of color into the fields of architecture and urban planning. Her winning project is called 400 Forward. Tiffany Brown, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Cynthia.
What is the significance of that name, 400 Forward?
So the significance of 400 Forward stemmed from the 400th living African-American woman becoming licensed this past August. So, and that's not 400 of, the last 10 years or 50 years. That's 400 of all time out of 110,000 licensed architects in the country. So when that happened this past August, I was just on a long run with the Urban Arts Collective, which we refer to as UAC, just kind of going around the country and teaching kids about architecture. And it just, pushed me to seek out the next 400 group of women, mostly African-American women, I guess I could say, because it's a number that represents 0.3%, like not even a half a percent of what the profession is. And, that's just not what our communities look like.
So it's time to change that conversation.
Yes.
So as an architectural designer, I know you're close to becoming a fully licensed architect once you pass some licensing exams. You're a rarity. You are an African-American woman, grew up in Detroit. How'd you get into architecture?
I was actually exposed to architecture indirectly throughout my life. Like no one came to my school to talk about architecture. So I grew up on the west side of Detroit. you know, in one of the more rough neighborhoods. And we just didn't have a lot of professionals coming there, period. So I was always drawing and drawing people in my class and just really into art. I had a wood shop class. So all of these things indirectly led me to architecture, because by the time I was in the 12th grade, someone from Lawrence Tech came to an assembly that we were having. Just, you know, she wasn't even an architect herself. She was just a recruiter. And by that time, I had become more interested in buildings and spaces. And so by that fall, at 17, I was starting, you know, undergrad at Lawrence Tech for Architecture. And 3 degrees later from there, I teach now.
There you are. And that isn't that fascinating that one person at the right time, mm-hmm. in the right place, opened up that door in your mm-hmm. mind to going down this path?
I have this little model that I try to be the face that I was looking for growing up. So if I go into a room or an auditorium and just one person is interested in architecture, then I've accomplished my mission.
So when you think of the reality that you just pointed out, that only 0.3% of licensed architects are Black women, what is being lost because of this lack of diversity?
Well, it's a profession that is integrated into our daily lives, the built environment, the spaces that we use every day. You know, there's just a lot of construction and resurgence of Detroit in particular, that they're being led by companies that don't have the necessary diversity in their company to, I would say, design for the people that they're designing for. So
that point about how about if the people designing the spaces are the people who are going to use them?
Yes. So that's exactly what I want to do with 400 Forward, is just to teach girls, let them know that they have the ability to design these spaces, and they kind of have the responsibility to be the ones that create the cities that they're living in, or, you know, other people will come in and do it for them.
How do you want to close the gap through 400 Forward? Just what is it, and how is it structured?
By closing the gap, one of the main things is exposure. So just going into the schools and neighborhoods where I grew up, you know, in other neighborhoods in the city of Detroit public schools in general, just to talk about what architecture means and talk about what urban planning means. And, you know, because they just don't know that they have the talent, you know, just try to pull it out of them and lead and guide and support them. And one way to support them is financially. So to study architecture is very expensive. To become licensed, the exams are very expensive. So this grant will help me assist professional women who are trying to become licensed in the field. And it will also help me assist grades K through 12, like students in that realm, to, you know, take them on trips and expose them to what architecture means.
And are you doing all this yourself, or do you have a core of people helping you?
You know, it's funny that you asked that, because the more exposure that, you know, my winning this grant is getting, I'm getting a lot of people reaching out to get involved. So that's a great feeling to know that, you know, there's just this whole audience of support that I didn't necessarily have to seek out. They're seeking me out. So I also have my colleagues and my fellow co-founders with Urban Arts Collective, who are Mike Ford and Eric Christian. And, you know, those two guys are great with initiatives that they've got going on. So, yeah, I do have a support system. It is a matching grant. So we are seeking out matching sponsors. And I know that there's a lot of money out there for STEM education. And, you know, I think that this would be a great cause.
Now, you are working real hard, Tiffany, to get girls looking at that pathway, women of color, to think of architecture and urban planning and design. If they pursue this rigorous path of study, will there be jobs for them?
Absolutely. There are jobs right now that, you know, just we don't have the people, we don't have the talent right now. I think if something like this had come up when I was a kid, we wouldn't have the drought right now with even construction workers, you know, people to build a diverse pool of people to do construction, to do architecture. Things are continuing to evolve. Technology is continuing to evolve. And so, you know, our STEM-related fields are just in need of diversity. So absolutely, there'll
be jobs.
There definitely will be jobs. There are jobs right now for them.
Here you are working through 400 Forward to make architecture more accessible for women of color. And so what do you hope your field looks like in 10 years?
So the communities right now that we have, they're diverse. you know, and it's kind of, architecture is just a stagnant profession going after projects in diverse communities. So what I would like to see 400 Forward do is to change that, and just, if you have a diverse team of architects or a diverse team of engineers or diverse team of scientists, it just makes for a better product.
How might the city of Detroit look different if more women of color were part of the design and the planning?
I think that Detroit would be much more inviting to the people who live there, to the people who are looking to live here, if it had the input from the people of the community involved in the decisions. I think that's what's missing from what's happening in Detroit right now.
Tiffany Brown is co-founder of the Urban Arts Collective and creator of 400 Forward, which won a matching 2017 Night Arts Challenge grant of $50,000, a matching grant, with her idea of bringing more women of color into the field of architecture and urban planning. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Cynthia.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on and issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is known across the country for its craft beer. We're now fifth in the nation, the number of breweries, microbreweries, and brew pubs. One of those early breweries that helped put Michigan beer on the map is, of course, Bell's in Kalamazoo. I spoke with Larry Bell in 2017, and we began with what brought him to brewing and to West Michigan.
I wound up in Kalamazoo to attend Kalamazoo College. And after college, I worked for a small European-style bakery called Zarcozy Bakery, which was yeast and grains. See, my dad was a home winemaker. I was interested in collecting beer cans.
I see things kind of forming.
Jimmy Carter legalized home brewing. And 1980, I moved into a house with some other guys, all like beer, and went out and bought a kit and started brewing in my basement. You know, and then I think it was 82, the Real Ale Company over in Chelsea opened. I kind of spied on them and saw what they were doing. Unfortunately for them, you know, their business was short-lived, but it was good to see what they had done.
And you had all these little seeds kind of planted anyway, so.
Yeah, my home brewing was getting a little out of control. I think the statute of limitations is over, so, you know, I might have been selling some cases out of the basement.
Maybe, sort of.
And there came a time I had a Fisher cut bait, and I got a check for my birthday for $200, and that's what I started the company with. I wrote to the federal government, said, what do I have to do to get a license? Because I got to make this legal.
And that happened in what, 85? You sold your first beer commercially in 85?
Yeah, I opened the homebrew store in 83, and then the brewery opened in 85.
Did I see somewhere that when you began brewing in Kalamazoo, it was the first time that beer had been brewed legally there since the Prohibition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The old Kalamazoo Brewing Company closed under local prohibition in 1915.
That's just mind-boggling when you think, you know, everywhere we go, there is a cool place to discover beer.
I think when I opened, there was probably less than 50 actual brewing companies in the country. And now we are north of 5,000.
That is unbelievable. And it has certainly been my sense, Larry Bell, that in the past decade, and really the last 5 years, Bell's has really emerged as one of Michigan's most recognizable companies. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, we've been around a long time. And when you go back to the early days, there was a point where I'm the only brewery in Michigan. And I'm loading my van on Fridays, and I'm driving to Ann Arbor and selling it over here. I'm driving to Lansing or Traverse City and Petoskey, even across the bridge. And in that way, I kind of became the local brewer to the state. And there's still people that, oh, you remember, you used to deliver in that old lousy van of yours. So there's a lot of old-time relationships that I and Bell's have across the state with people. We've been here a long time. You know, on top of that, I think we make really excellent quality beer.
When you think of, particularly West Michigan, we think of the breweries that have emerged as major players nationally. Bell's, Founders comes to mind. Is there something special about West Michigan that makes it particularly hospitable to the beer business?
I think what's happened in Michigan, and I don't really want to toot my own horn here, but it's not just West Michigan. I think for the state, you know, when Bell's opened up, we had certain ideals of the kind of beer we wanted to make, and those were bigger beers and all. And so other people that came along then said, hey, that's what's working, so let's make that style of beer as well. Let's really go for this thing. So, you know, Founders or over here Jolly Pumpkin or Shorts up north, people said, wow, we as Michigan brewers, we really make some great beer and we got to keep that up. We can't be, you know, sloughing this thing. And so I think what happens then is Michigan gets this great reputation for having big, bold, beautiful beers.
And all boats rise. We get a sense that there's a pretty close-knit community in the Michigan brewing community. A lot of collaboration?
You know, there is. Things are changing.
Okay, how so?
Well, the entire craft beer world is changing. We've seen an incredible influx of large corporations buying up small breweries, private equity people coming in. Things may not be quite as collaborative and groovy as they were even 10 years ago.
Interesting. Yeah, that, as you say, that injects a whole new kind of feel to it. What about the little smaller breweries? How much do you maybe talk with them, maybe help them along this path that you have navigated so successfully?
You know, a lot of help that happens will come through. We have a professional organization, the Master Brewers Association. Mm-hmm. So we have quarterly meetings, we do technical talks, and that's a great time for people on the technical side of things to get together, learn what's going on, do brewery visits. I mean, there is a lot of camaraderie on that level. You know, that happens for us too with the big guys. I mean, we've had issues where we've called our friends at Miller and said, hey, we got an issue, we don't know, can you help? We've done some testing for small breweries out.
Yeah.
We'll do that now and then. Hey, do you know what you have? No, not really. Why don't you give me a bottle? I'll take it over to the lab. We'll run it for you.
Okay.
You know, we'll give you a baseline.
What kind of advice might you give, you know, Larry, you've all these decades of success in making this happen, talking to someone right now who is brewing beer in their basement and maybe dreams of growing that into the next Bell's?
A lot of the places that are opening are brew pubs or tap rooms, which that seems to be the most popular and successful model right now for people getting into the business. Going into packaging, then you really need to have something special to make yourself stand out in a very crowded field. And at retail, at the restaurant bar level, it's tough to get that space right now.
Boy, I just think of, you know, walking into the grocery store and just what presents you there as you walk up to the options is mind-blowing.
Yeah, and you say, you know, small breweries, but, you know, a brewery like Bell's or Sierra Nevada or New Belgium, you know, we have pretty sophisticated sales teams, marketing teams now. You know, when you're starting out, people invest in the brewery, but they also have to remember to invest in people to be able to get out there and deal with wholesalers and retailers. And you have to kind of know how to play that game and have some resources for that as well.
You know, as a business owner, you're looking ahead over the next, say, 5 or 10 years. What are your biggest concerns?
Well, for me, it's been succession, and my daughter is now CEO. I retain the title of president, but my daughter, Laura, next generation, is coming up. So for me, that's been a big challenge. The easiest thing to do when you get older and look for an exit strategy is to sell.
Right.
Hardest thing to do is to pass it on to your family. That takes a lot of work. But she's great, and so we've been managing that transition, and I have less reports. As I sit here today with you, I have far fewer people reporting to me, and life is a little bit easier.
A little more. I'm just interested. When you go out on a Saturday night anywhere, what beer do you order? What's your go-to fave beer?
When I go out on a Saturday night, I'm usually out with Mrs. Bell, who doesn't drink beer.
Okay.
So I might not be drinking beer. I might be helping her out with a bottle of wine. Now,
if you're not with Mrs. Bell and it's beer time,
you know,
what's your favorite?
There's a beer that actually has an Ann Arbor connection that we brew seasonally called Quinanon Falls. And the beer came to me in a dream one night when I was staying at the Campus Inn. It was a very vivid dream, and I woke up and drew the label on the Campus Inn notepad next to my bed. And driving home, I called the brewer, said, we're going to make this. And I called the artist I knew up in Grand Rapids area and told her, you're going to paint my dream. And she did. And
is there a Quinanon Falls?
No, it only exists in my imagination.
Okay.
It's sort of the Brigadoon of the Boreal North. The natives knew about this. If you're pure of heart, it'll come to you once, twice in your life, and you spend the day in introspection, examining the spirit world in your own life at Quinanon Falls.
Larry Bell, founder and now president of Bell's Brewery, and seemingly enjoying that new role very, very much. It was great to talk with you. Thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Nearly 13,000. That's how many children are in foster care in Michigan, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. And you look across the country, there are some 400,000 kids in foster care on any given day. But what we don't know for sure is how many children have been lost in foster care. Shenandoah Scheffalo knows how easily that can happen. The Traverse City-based author and advocate put herself into foster care when she was only 13, the only way she could think of to escape her abusive home life and her parents. But it wasn't long before she realized if she disappeared, nobody would care. Nobody would come looking for her. And today she leads a grassroots project called #4600 and Counting. It's aimed at finding those lost children. Shenandoah, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
Your memoir, Garbage Bag Suitcase, is a powerful, unsettling read, which it should be. It tells the story of your childhood and how you wound up at the age of 13 asking, please put me in foster care. Could you give us an idea of what was going on with your father and mother up to that point?
Yeah, well, I had never known my biological father, so he had never been a part of my life. Through that time, I didn't find my biological father until after I turned 18 and was out of the system. And prior to that, I had lived with my mother and, in fact, had been born in San Diego, California. But we had moved over 50 times across the country, 35 schools before I finally graduated from high school. And it was what I think is a pretty typical foster care experience in that lots of dysfunction, lots of mental illness, lots of drug and alcohol abuse and addiction on my mother's part, lots of men in and out of my mom's life and thus my life. And it was dysfunction as we all know and love it. But it was a story that I really wanted to keep a secret from myself and from the world. It wasn't something I wanted to share because it was so painful. When you go through those experiences, you find yourself, even as a child, you know, wondering what you had done to ever deserve those sorts of things. And so for me, the idea of sharing this story really came to fruition in my professional life, watching clients in my office at the time working at a criminal defense office who were sort of on that revolving criminal justice wheel, who often disclosed that they had spent time in foster care. Mm. And I thought, gosh, this is Traverse City and it's such a small community. How come so many of our clients could have spent time in foster care? And so that really set me on the wheel of wanting to start to share my story with the idea that if I share the story, right, everyone's always interested in what I call the car accident or train wreck of someone's life. If they would stick around and we could talk about what we need to do to fix it and how the foster care is at the core of so many other social issues that most of us care about in our communities.
Shenandoah, you endured terrible, terrible abuse as a child. It is heartbreaking to read the things that were done to you. And then at 13, you decided to enter the foster care system. Now, tell us what those years were like for you.
Well, you know, I was a 13-year-old girl, and I thought that the foster care system was going to be the answer. You know, I had ideas of Annie and Daddy Warbucks sort of floating around my 13-year-old brain. And I really thought that it was going to be a place where, listen, we've picked the best people our state has to offer to become foster parents, right? They've had background checks, they've gone through classes and training. And so I thought that's what I would get. unfortunately for me, it was just sort of more of the same. You know, there's this comic, Monroe Martin, who talks about his experience in foster care. And he says, if you don't know what foster care is, it's where we take kids who are in dysfunctional and abusive family situations, and we remove them from that, and we place them in the exact same situation, but with total strangers. And, you know, I mean, he does it. He's a comedian, right?
Yeah.
But it's really raw and really true at the same time. I mean, that's what makes him so brilliant, is that for me, it was just more of the same. I never fit in. I was never sort of doing what I was supposed to be doing. I could always be doing more. I knew I wasn't part of the family. And some of that was at the whim of foster parents that I lived with. And part of that was, you know, state rules and guidelines that don't allow foster kids to do certain things. You know, you couldn't be part of family photos. You couldn't go on family trips that were outside of the state without permission. You couldn't have sleepovers at friends' house because their parents weren't licensed foster care workers. I mean, sort of all those things that would give you a normal childhood are taken from you. And you're trying to navigate that. Even at 13, as the person who called and put myself into care, I didn't understand all the consequences of what that would be.
And then take us through what happened through foster care. Did you finally age out?
I aged out of foster care, which for me, I turned 18 halfway through my senior year of high school, which means that at midnight, you're done. You're cut loose from the system. And which is why we see that most foster youth who age out will end up homeless. Half the boys will end up with a felony conviction before 19 and a half, and half the girls will end up pregnant before 19 and a half. So it's a large portion. So in my case, I was going to turn 18 halfway through my senior year. All I really wanted was to graduate from high school. I hadn't known anyone who had graduated from high school. That was a big deal for me. And so I was trying to figure out how I was going to do that, how I could stay in school until May to graduate from high school. And on my way to my part-time minimum wage job one day, I thought, well, what if I just offered to pay my foster parents the amount they had been receiving from the state of Michigan? And if I paid them that, would they allow me to just stay until May? Because that would be way cheaper than me trying to get an apartment and a car and transportation and figuring it out. And so I came home from work and asked them, and we ran the numbers, and we realized that if I worked 25 hours a week at my minimum wage, I would barely have enough after taxes to pay them. But they agreed. And so that agreement bought me that extra 6 months of time to graduate from high school. So I worked full time, you know, almost full time at that job, went to school, and was able to get myself to graduate from high school. So that's how I managed some time. During that 6 months, I had a teacher who asked me what my plan was after high school graduation. And I vividly remember telling her, I'm just going to get more hours at this. I was working at a hardware store at the time, at this hardware store. They really like me there. The manager said he'll give me more hours. I could get myself on a management track. And that was my big plan after high school. She thought I should apply to college, which was really the first time in my life anyone had ever even talked about college. She sent me to my guidance counselor's office, and I walked in his office, and he looked me square in the eye and said, you know, Shen, people like you don't go to college. People like you learn to serve people like me.
Whoa.
And I thought, yeah. And I thought, gosh, you're absolutely right. I mean, people, when I say that phrase to people, you know, I hear a lot of, oh my goodness, or that's crazy, or who could ever say that? But the truth was that 18-year-old girl sitting across from him absolutely agreed with him. I had heard that countless times, you know, social workers, caseworkers, foster parents, judges, every adult surrounding me was essentially waiting for me to turn into my mother.
Boy.
That was the quest held out for me. You know, my mom had two children by the time she was 21, never graduated from high school, had been married, you know, four or five times. I've sort of have lost count. And had this alcohol drug addiction. She had a mental illness. So I thought, listen, at some point, I'm just turning into that. And that was my goal for myself. That was surely everyone else's goal for me. And luckily for me, when I walked back down to my teacher's room and told her the story, You know, her head looked like an 80s horror movie that it was going to spin around and pop off of her body. And she helped me fill out college applications. So much so that when she realized I couldn't afford the application fee, she's the one who eventually stepped up and wrote the $125 check to Michigan State University so I could apply. I eventually got in. And I thought that was going to be my saving grace, right? Like, I got into college, I had a dorm, I had some place to live. And it turned out that it wasn't. And that's where I started having this realization that I could disappear and nobody would even come looking for me. Nobody would even know that I was gone.
But we should tell everybody, and as you learn in reading your memoir, Garbage Bag Suitcase, you did beat the odds. You became one of the only 1% of all foster care kids who graduate from college. You live with your husband and daughter in Traverse City. And it is a story really worth reading. And now you've kind of launched this petition on change.org called #4600 and counting. What's the significance of that name?
So the significance is that every year, the child welfare system loses about 1.1% of the kids in the child welfare system. So we have somewhere between 4,600 kids that no one knows where they are. So state authorities, you know, have taken control of these kids, have removed them from their homes, and they have just sort of miraculously disappeared into the system. And this started when someone on social media shared with me an article out of Kansas about three girls who had disappeared. And ultimately, some state senators were interested in why and had called, you know, and had this big congressional hearing about why these girls were missing. And the article shook me to my core so much, not because kids were missing. I knew kids had run away and gone missing before. We've seen the headlines, you know, kids found strangled or dead, you know, from the foster care system. I knew that was happening. What shook me to my core was it seemed to just be acceptable by all the people in power. It was sort of stated in the article, well, listen, in Kansas, we're missing roughly 73 kids, and that's less than 1.1% of our state foster care population. So we're beating the national average. We're doing fine. Hmm. And it was just sort of the non-caring nature of the somehow the fact that even one kid was missing wasn't one kid too many that just really sort of punched me in my gut. And I reached out to another homeless youth advocate that I knew in Toronto. And I said, I mean, why is nobody talking about this? If you statistically run the numbers, that means they're losing 88 kids a week.
And I think those of us who you know, kind of have that assumption that, well, they're being cared for, just how are kids lost in the foster care system?
Oh, in all sorts of ways. Obviously, the number one way is by running away, that kids will run away from a foster home. Now, kids run away all the time. Kids run away from, you know, their biological parents' home. Kids run away. It's something they do. The problem is that in foster care, nobody goes to look for them. A kid may run away. A foster parent may or may not report that. A caseworker may or may not report that. And then that's sort of the end of it. Even if that child's reported to authorities, nobody's out there sort of beating the bushes looking for the kid. Now, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and if she ran away, you know, I would have posters up. I would sort of be the person leading the march. And that's part of the problem. There's nobody leading the march for these kids. And so they disappear. And what we know is especially for girls who run away, is that within 48 hours, they will be approached by sex traffickers on the streets. It's a proven statistic. We know that a lot of the kids that disappear from foster care wind up in human trafficking and human sex trafficking rings and organizations.
So what is the whole point of #4600 and counting? What kind of shape is it taking?
Yeah, it's been amazing to watch the stories pour in from people who have children who have been missing from the foster care system. And more importantly for us, it's about changing what happens. So what we want to see happen is that when a kid enters foster care, that we basically would put together a safety kit for them, that they'd have their photo taken, that photo would be updated every 6 months that they're in care, that we would have some sort of DNA swab taken, and that we have some medical and dental records on that child. child so that if they do go missing, we are able to do what we would do for any other child or something that any parent would do for their child, which is put a poster together, put an alert out to be on the lookout for all of those things. What we're finding is that authorities sometimes are finding children, both dead and alive, that they can't identify because there's no record of them. So that, yes, they've been in the child welfare system, but we don't have any DNA. We don't have any updated photos. We don't have any of those things to help us even identify bodies. And so part of what 4600 and Counting is doing is bringing the awareness, letting people know that this is a problem and something we need to address, but also that we need to change the way in which we're approaching the situation. So we want to have these safety kits. And then we want to be able to have caseworkers checking in to make sure that these kids are where they're supposed to be. And we hear oftentimes from caseworkers, and we know that they're overworked. They have too many kids on their caseloads. They can't keep track of everyone. And we're just suggesting, hey, we could bring in some technology to help. It's really easy to Skype or FaceTime with people. Can you do a 5-minute, you know, Skype or FaceTime with the family and the child at least every 30 days so that we're checking to make sure these kids are accounted for? Because there are numerous cases where a kid has disappeared and a foster family has continued cashing checks and nobody even knows that the child is gone or missing.
How can people help if they want to? What can people do?
The fastest and easiest way is to log on to change.org and sign the petition. We would love for people to share the video that Marnie and myself put together talking about our own journey, what happened to me, what happened to her. Marnie has a similar story, although she didn't choose foster care the way I did it at 13. At 13, she chose to hit the streets instead and was raped and abused numerous times and lived the life on the streets and understands that really well and understands what that looks like really well. So we got to find the balance of privacy and saving children's lives. And the only way we can do that, that I know how to do that, is by making some noise and making people aware of the situation and getting as many signatures on the petition we can. So both the head of Health and Human Services in the U.S. and the president and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will take a look at it and realize that this is a cause that we need to put some effort and energy behind.
And it certainly seems, just from reading your book, Garbage Bag Suitcase, and hearing you talk, this is also a battle cry to change what you see. Someone who's been through the foster care system, it's broken and it needs fixing.
Well, it's not just broken, it's shattered, right? In my view, we need to make sure that these children are at the core of what we're trying to do to fix it. Because somewhere along the line, we've lost the idea that all these numbers and statistics are beating hearts in real people who grow up. I mean, every child in care is going to grow up and be an adult. And then when they're not acting in a way that we deem socially acceptable, we're going to want to take action against that, right? We're going to want to try to put them in jail or prison to reform their behavior. We're going to want to try to ask, well, why is that mom having all of these children? Why is this mom on welfare? Why is all of this? Why won't they just work? Why won't they just do this? And the answer lies behind not what their current behavior is showing us, but what has happened to them. And I think we've somehow forgotten that these are children who are abused and mistreated. Nobody comes into foster care because things are great at home. Everyone comes in because something really terrible has happened to them. And we have to really help them heal that if we're going to have better outcomes in the future.
You can go to change.org and search for hashtag 4600 and counting to learn more about this effort from my guest, Shenandoah Sheffalo. Her book is Garbage Bag Suitcase. Shenandoah, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. And one quick note, today's show featured a couple of interviews that aired previously on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.